So we're back.
We're back.
We're both alive.
Yes, alive. And we are now online instructors full time.
Oh, God. Yeah. And there's a difference between doing it intentionally and doing it because you're suddenly forced to do it, right?
Yeah, that's been a huge thing. So we're supposed to be doing evaluations of one another. And I was supposed to have a colleague come and evaluate my class, my in-person class, like a couple weeks ago. And they're like, well, now we're just going to, you know, evaluate your online modules. And I'm like, what? Oh. Like, no, like I didn't design the class to be online. And so it is, it's totally different. A class that's in person and the content that you give, the assignments, everything, it's so different than what you would do if you were to be fully online. And so now I don't feel good about this. Like I'm going to be judged on something that wasn't not intentional, but it's okay.
I mean, so this has inspired us to kind of, we're going to continue the podcast. We're going to do some stuff that's a little different, right?
Yes. It has inspired us to do stuff a little bit different, but probably won't be that bit different of an experience for people who are listening or who are regular listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be an abrupt change, right? I think it's this. So Hillary approached me a couple of weeks ago and we've been trying to figure out a way to get this thing restarted. And a lot of people are home right now. A lot of parents are home right now having to manage their children's education. And maybe they could use a little bit of help, right?
Yeah. So we're going to be offering basically like a sequential U.S. history offering for like, we're going to start with the second half of the U.S. survey and just kind of go through things chronologically, talk about things in the way that we ordinarily do, but do it in a more structured manner where it's chronological.
Right. So it's chronological and it's thematic within the chronology, right? So there are a couple of issues that are going to come up in today's episode. I imagine a parent would listen to this more than a child, unless the child's like maybe junior high school or older.
I really hope children aren't listening to this.
Because
it's inappropriate.
I think a high school student would do fine with it.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I think it could be helpful for like AP US history or something.
Maybe. Right, but I think much younger than that, probably not, right? So this is geared to kind of college age, high school age, and then parents who suddenly find themselves having to be experts on everything at home.
Yeah, so any parents out there who are trying to teach, for example, this week, reconstruction to their AP US history students, this episode is for you.
Yeah, so Hillary told us there's our topic for this week is reconstruction, and it's interesting. Both Hillary and I are heavily invested in the 19th century, and I know we have some strong opinions about reconstruction. Let's get to it. Let's start the podcast. Welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary,
and I'm Jeff.
And we're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
Reconstruction. I dislike this topic and the positioning of it in the U.S. survey. And I don't know how you feel about this. I didn't even run this by you, but I want your opinion. So when you teach the U.S. history survey, it's usually taught in two parts. The first part is, you know, the founding to the Civil War. And then the second part is typically reconstruction through the present. And I don't like that split up. It gives me like insane anxiety to start a class by like, let's talk about reconstruction day one. I don't like it. How do you feel about that?
I mean, first, I start my U.S. survey sequence with the first people setting foot in the Americas.
Well, yes, yes.
I'm sorry. Gosh. I just had to troll you a little bit about that.
You are trolling me. You know?
But so here's the thing. So at the UCs, we actually get 3/4 to teach the U.S. sequence, which means Reconstruction comes kind of within a quarter, kind of in the second half, but not towards the end and definitely not at the beginning. And I like it because you need context around it.
You really need context around it. That's the whole thing is if you have, and I have students who do this all the time who take the sequence out of order. So they'll be like, oh, I'm just going to start with the second half and then I'll go do the first half later. It's like, oh, you really, really need the context of setting up what goes on, you know, 100 years prior is important. But I mean, really, knowing enough about the Civil War is so important in order to even delve into Reconstruction. So we'll offer a little context here first, but then kind of dive into what is Reconstruction and what were the successes and failures and what the ongoing debate around that is.
So I think it's important for us to kind of first establish what we mean when we talk about Reconstruction. So Reconstruction is this period at the end of and right after the Civil War. And we're going to talk about a couple of different kinds of Reconstruction. Hopefully we'll even have time for a conversation about, is that term even useful? Historians are kind of revisiting that term now and asking, is it even a useful term? But in defense of having it at the start of part two of the U.S. sequence, I would say this. There are strong threads between Reconstruction, what becomes the Jim Crow South at the turn of the century, and then the modern civil rights movement. There's a lot of continuity between those three, and I would hate to not be able to teach Reconstruction and also talk about those other two things.
That makes a lot of sense, and I do agree it is important to talk about them in the same semester and in conjunction in conversation with one another. But I can make the argument backwards too, right, where it's a shame to talk about the Constitution and mm-hmm. and talk about the Civil War, but not talk about what happens in the wake of that, right? So it's like, it's hard. I mean, I guess if you were to ask me when should it be cut, I don't know. I guess I don't have the best answer to that. But you're right. It is an important topic to be able to talk about alongside what happens in 100 years after, right, in the 1960s. So you're right. But it's I guess what I'm saying is it's challenging to begin the semester with Reconstruction. And so you have a different opportunity in the quarter system. But to me, it's hard to just dive right into such a contentious topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what do you think about – so I know some professors who teach both parts, and I've done this before. I teach it in both.
That's what I do. So that was going to be my
– I double dip, right?
That is, like, yeah. My last module in the first half of the sequence is Reconstruction. My first module in the first half of the second sequence is Reconstruction. Yes, I absolutely do double dip.
But you,
for the students who take it out of order, that doesn't quite help them.
But you probably approach it differently in the two sequences, right?
Yes.
I mean, Reconstruction, I think, in the second sequence is usually an unfinished – task, right? Whereas Reconstruction in the first one kind of lays bare questions about was the system that was established in the United States fundamentally flawed from the beginning and we needed some kind of reset on it. But before we kind of get to that, which I, for me, that's something I'd like to discuss towards the end is where do we place it? I mean, let's set the context up for Reconstruction.
Okay. So as the Civil War comes to a close,
should I play like battle music during this or something?
I think that might be nice. Ambiance.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. No, I'm joking.
Feel free to edit that out. So at the close of the Civil War, and we know we could get into Civil War for episodes and episodes and episodes, but at the close of it, we know that slavery has come to an end, but there's no agreement or vision on how to proceed. There are many visions, but there's no agreement on how to proceed. The word slavery had never even been in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment, which of course abolishes slavery in the entire Union. But the question that comes out of the Civil War is, what is freedom? What is going to happen to people in the South who were formerly enslaved and now free, to people who were fighting and who had seceded? How is the country going to move forward? And with all of these questions left unanswered, it created fighting. And when I was doing the research for this episode, I was thinking about pivotal moments in history and moments where you have an opportunity to restructure things because something so calamitous has occurred that the very order and structure of things has to change in the wake of that, and what the opportunities there can be. And when we look back on Reconstruction, we can see so many missed opportunities. Thinking too much about what's going on currently with our pandemic about restructuring. But when we think about the Civil War, I mean, the entire structure of society had to change. And when there was no vision for that and no ability to move forward and no agreement, it obviously set the stage for this huge drama to play out. And we touched a little bit on it in our impeachment episode, right, about Johnson. So we can go into a little bit more about that. But I would say the lingering question, though, is what is freedom and what does freedom look like for people post-Civil War?
So I'm going to pull a historian move, and I'm going to push this back a little bit. And I would say kind of two things kick off Reconstruction. First, the Emancipation Proclamation, right? So the Emancipation Proclamation, given during the Civil War, emancipates slaves in the states currently in rebellion against the Union. It does not abolish slavery in border states like Kentucky, but it opens the window for that. And the second thing is Lincoln's 10% plan. So 1863, Abraham Lincoln develops a plan of how you're going to reintegrate the South back into the Union. And it's a 10% plan. And it's basically a plan that 10% of the voters, numerically from the 1860 election, had to pledge allegiance to the United States and obey emancipation laws. And those states would be admitted back in the Union wholly. It's interesting. I grew up in the South and kind of went through most of my K through 12 in the South. And it's interesting that Lincoln is so demonized because this plan that he puts forward is so minimal requirement wise for the South.
So minimal, 10%. That I think that was appeasing beyond.
Yeah. Well, he said he wanted a reconciliation as quick as possible. And it's unclear even to this day, did Lincoln was he willing to push to have slavery abolished across the country? You kind of have to triangulate from his speeches. You know, slavery had been abolished in the South for the most part because of the Emancipation Proclamation, but he kind of prioritized reintegration of the South within the broader Union over the rights of freed people, over the concerns of those formerly enslaved people having to make their way in this country that's come back together. He prioritized the Union over that. And I think it's important we understand that.
Well, and in doing that, had no, again, plan for what the world would look like or how it would take shape for people who were freed from slavery, because you're right, it hardly had anything to do with helping anybody or making life easier for anybody, but about how do we get back to normal? And it was that excitement or zeal or just strong desire to get back to a sense of normalcy that just wrecked all of the possibilities for fixing longstanding problems. And then for helping to fix problems that we're still working with today, right? Because of the excitement to just get everybody back into the union and create, you know, like, let's be friends again, it just left a lot of people out in the cold.
Yeah. So like Lincoln proposes, makes this proposal, and his Republicans in Congress really reject it. And the interesting thing is this, I think there's a division on why they're rejecting it. So some are rejecting it because they think it's too lenient, that this long bloody war has been fought, union blood's been spilled, and there has to be payment rendered for that union blood. And then I think you have another group, and there is some overlap between the groups, that are saying this 10% plan doesn't work because it doesn't ensure that we don't end up with the same system all over again in the South.
Exactly. Exactly. Yet most of the Republicans at the time, and again, we have to reiterate that the parties have since flipped, but most of the Republicans at the time were not keen on just becoming friendly again with the South, because they knew that, yes, that the old system would perhaps prevail again, but also that if you're thinking about secession, it was treachery. I mean, they were traitors to the country, and there were so many people who were not ready to just shake hands and forget about it and say, let's move on. And so many people in the union and so many leaders at the time wanted to, in essence, occupy the South and reign and run their government in order to make sure that it ran smoothly. And to just say, oh, well, I just need an oath of loyalty from 10% of the population, there's no way that that was going to cut it. And when Johnson comes into power and starts, you know, kind of actually sort of going along with some of the things that Abraham Lincoln had wanted, but then even more so had gone even in a more lenient direction. I mean, this just creates a huge splinter with the Republicans in the North. They're not happy with this acquiescence, right? I mean,
Well, we get a good idea in 1864 when the Republicans, the Congressional Republicans, put forth their own plan, right? So Lincoln has his 10% plan. Congressional Republicans introduce this Wade Davis bill. It passes both the House and the Senate, goes to Lincoln. Lincoln vetoes it. It would have required 50% of states' voters in 1860 to take this Pledge of Allegiance. It also, they felt, safeguarded the return to kind of, so to guarantee emancipation would continue. But embedded in this idea was this state suicide theory. And they basically argued that any state that rebelled against the Union, that had seceded, had forfeited all rights, so that anything Congress chose to give them was a gift.
Gift. And that was seen as so radical. But to me, looking back on it, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, that seems appropriate to me. But it was seen as being along some of the more radical lines of appeasement or bringing the union back together, because it was going to make so many people mad. But the fact is, though, I mean, when these conversations were happening, the war was ongoing. Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it interesting? Lincoln is like making his 10% plan in 1863.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the war is still raging. And so I understand if you're in the heat of that moment where, I mean, you have tens of thousands of people dying, you know, battle after battle after battle, you can see how heated some of the Republicans would be in the North, or some of the folks in the Union in the North would be so upset over how much bloodshed there's been that they want punishment. They don't want an easy end to it. And so it's interesting what you said about growing up in the South and that Abraham Lincoln gets such a bad rap in the South. But like, I mean, he wasn't being radical at all.
Right. I mean, apart from the fact, I mean, you know, emancipation, but I don't think I hope none of my teachers were defending a pushback against emancipation. That's a little frightening. But so we get, you know, Lincoln's not very radical at all. And the majority of Republicans in Congress actually generally side with Lincoln on this. However, they want Congress to drive this, not Lincoln. Right? They want Congress to kind of be in the driver's seat of what Reconstruction is going to look like. But then you have this smaller group within the Republican Party, the radical Republicans. And what they want to do is they say, this is an opportunity to actually reconstruct society.
Yes. And looking back on it, that's what I was saying is so sad, is that it is an opportunity to actually reform society and address longstanding issues. And it's just not done. So you have the radical Republicans, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, were the two, would you say the two leading radical mm-hmm. Republicans? And I mean, they had visions for the way that things could have run in the South, and they were just seen as so far out of the field of what was possible that I think it was out of fear, right? People were too afraid to actually go that route and make things different. And what I think a lot of people talk about, oh, the failure of Reconstruction. I mean, I guess that the failure is from a 21st century perspective, we see all these missed opportunities. But if you're thinking about it from their moment, from that moment, they really are trying to just patch up the carnage, right? So to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's this conflict in the Republican Party and the war kind of winds down and Lincoln's assassinated.
So sad right and, there at the end.
Right there at the end. And I mean, it's kind of like FDR not living to see the actual conclusion of World War II.
Yes. Yes.
So Lincoln kind of dies there, gets assassinated, and Andrew Johnson, who found himself vice president because of Lincoln's conciliatory attitude, right?
Trying to appease the South, yes.
He had brought this Southerner in on the ticket with him, and he wanted this healing to take place. So Andrew Johnson suddenly finds himself president, and many Southerners must have been licking their chops after this, right?
Yeah, because they knew that they had someone pretty much on their side, and that turns out to be the case.
Not true at all.
Well, no, it is true.
It is, but it isn't, right? I mean, the whole thing is, look at Johnson's Reconstruction Proclamation in 1865 that he gives. I mean, granted, some of it's pretty minor, but some of it's pretty substantive. So they have to repeal the ordinances of succession, which is fine. But they also have to repudiate Confederate debts. So if anybody owed money to the Confederacy, it was gone. It was just wiped. Mm-hmm. They had to say that debt doesn't exist anymore. And they have to ratify the 13th Amendment.
That's a really short order.
It is, but it's more than 10% of the voting population.
So here's the thing, though. So I'm glad that we disagree on this. I think he was so perfect for the Southerners, because if you think about it, it's like those are the only requirements that they have: to abolish slavery, denounce succession, and not pay debts. All of those things would have happened. All of those things did happen because the war ended. Just by mm-hmm. very virtue of the war ending and the Emancipation Proclamation, like it was over. And the fact that he granted the states the freedom in managing their local governments and rebuilding their state by state, I felt like that was just really appeasing them, because I guess it's hindsight, right? But we do know mm-hmm. that things went right back.
Well, what about his disenfranchising all the wealthy Southerners?
I mean, kind of. He doesn't grant them pardons initially. But eventually grant them pardons, and like they're still okay.
Well, that's so what I want to do is like put us back into May 1865, that moment he announces what this is going to look like. It seems a little harsher than Lincoln. It doesn't seem as harsh as the radical Republicans, definitely, but it seems a little harsher than Lincoln wanted.
It's hard to say, because Lincoln, we never know what Lincoln would have actually, of course, done.
Right.
Seeing the war end and actually being confronted with, hey, now it's time to rebuild. But it's a little more a little more conservative than what Lincoln was proposing initially, but I almost feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, I feel like when Lincoln's proposing these things in 1863, it's like appeasement, like, hey, you know, we're not even mad at you. Just 10% of you have to agree with us. We just want this to end. Do you think that there's any possibility that that was a ploy to just get end?
Oh, yeah. It's that it's a tactic to get them to come back into the Union and say, look, things aren't going well. We should just kind of surrender. We're going to be welcomed back. It'll be easy to get 10% to kind of do this loyalty oath. And then we can just move on.
Yeah, maybe
it was, right? I mean, that is true. We don't know what Lincoln's actual plan of Reconstruction would have looked like. But Johnson's, I mean, here's my take on it. I think some Southerners initially liked the idea of Johnson. But then when he announces it in May 65, I think they're a little like, oh, this sounds a little harsher than I thought.
We have to say sorry.
I'm going to have to grovel to President Johnson and ask for a pardon. But then Johnson makes it clear pretty quickly that he's willing to issue these pardons like crazy.
Oh, my gosh.
He goes pardon crazy. And the interesting thing is by 1868, he actually summarily pardons anybody who he had not previously pardoned.
Yes. So there's no, I mean, to me, it seems like, is if there's virtually no punishment whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, they're almost rewarded. So one thing that happens during the Civil War is so much land is seized, so much property, Southern property. And as Sherman is going, you know, marching his way up through the South and burning everything in its wake, he's seizing this land, right? And he gives it away. I mean, the whole concept of 40 acres and a mule, that comes from Sherman, from General Sherman. And he was giving land to freed slaves, former enslaved people. And so he's giving land to all these black families, and he's giving them old mules from the regiment, right? The regiments, right? We're like, oh, we're not using these mules anymore. You can take the mule. And he's giving them these lands, mostly off of islands, off of like the coasts, right? Like these areas like North and Southern South Carolina. And he's just giving people land. He's like, oh yeah, this is what we're going to do, right? Well, Johnson comes in and all of that land that is seized, he's like, oh no, I'm giving it all back. And they had to go and actually make announcements to these folks who had settled on this land and were living on it. Sorry, we're taking it back. So it's not just that they were welcomed back in, but then they were rewarded by getting their land back that they had lost. So I'm sorry, I get so heated when I read this stuff and like get back into it, because I'm just like, why did you do that? It was already gone. They had already capitulated, right? The war was over, and then you give them back what they lost in the war and take it from people who needed it.
One of the things we talk about, and one of the kind of provocative questions you ask students when you talk about Reconstruction and then what the situation for formerly enslaved peoples become kind of towards the end of the 19th century, then into the beginning of the 20th century, material conditions for some people deteriorate
drastically.
And it goes against, so first of all, you have individual freedom, which is kind of priceless, but at the same time, the South starts to institute these black codes, right? So when emancipation hits and these states surrender and they suddenly have to, emancipation is being enforced because, I mean, when Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, it's only in theory, right? Until Union soldiers are in the area, it's impossible to enforce. But once they're there, you have people who had been enslaved kind of leaving the plantations. These plantations are left with no workforce. And the states, as they move back in, quickly create a series of laws designed to guarantee their workforce. So these black codes start to do these contracts. They start to make people sign labor contracts. There are stiff penalties if you violate the labor contracts. The labor contracts, in a lot of ways, remind me of these labor this labor force, and they create these contracts. And the contracts really kind of remind me of those indentured servitude contracts.
Oh, yeah.
Where if you did anything that would violate it in any way, it would automatically get extended for a certain number of years.
Yeah. And that's what's crazy about it, right? It's like anybody who didn't sign, any black person who didn't sign a yearly labor contract could be arrested. And guess what happens when you're arrested? You get hired out to work on a state labor project. You will be, that's what, you know, of course, convict labor is happening and leasing. You know, the state would lease out convicts to work in sharecropping, essentially. But now they are enslaved again through the prisons. And this is, the 13th Amendment says this very specifically, is that you cannot be enslaved unless you're a prisoner. But, you know, establishing these codes that say you have to have a yearly contract working for someone who you may have formerly worked for, or you'll be arrested if you don't, they're just re-enslaved. Sharecropping is re-enslavement, even though, so this is the whole question, right, that's surrounding this, is what is freedom? Because yes, you are free, but what does that mean? Free to do what? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not free to do whatever you feel like doing. Like you're not free to work your own land. You're not free to, you know, have your income and support your family in the way that you want to, or what, you know what I'm saying? Like it's so stringent. The black codes make it even worse. And you're saying that, you know, people's quality of life sometimes diminished after, and that's really controversial to say, because I would never argue that people were better off enslaved, but because there was no vision or allowance for their freedom, and there was no establishment of what freedom means, they became re-enslaved and in worse conditions in some cases.
I mean, you do have a migration of some people who move out of the South and move to places like Kansas, right? It's not a huge number, but it is. There are some people who are actually able to escape that system. But it's the material conditions in a lot of ways degenerate because, and students always get uncomfortable when I say this, there was some rationale for a slave owner to protect the life of the enslaved peoples. Well, because it was your capital. It was your capital.
It's property, right? So when we talk about Johnson giving back seized property, Johnson gives back land, but obviously not slaves, because slaves are no longer property. But it is a really uncomfortable thing to discuss. But because people were property, there was an incentive to care for the property, not as humans, but as an asset. And once slaves are no longer property, what is the incentive to care?
There's none. There's none, there right? I mean, so you see these former plantation owners, or these plantation owners, you see these sharecropping contracts that are just punitive, right? I mean, you can only buy stuff at the store the plantation runs, the plantation store. They'll kind of give you credit, but then that credit has ridiculous interest rates on it. If you have a bad harvest, that's okay. They'll front you money for next time. However, you find yourself suddenly very much way behind on all these payments, and you're basically working the rest of your life for these people, and you have no choice because you have a contract that if you try to leave, you can be arrested and put in an even worse situation. So the first state to kind of institute these black codes is Mississippi.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the heart of the Cotton Belt. It's the Cotton Belt states who are kind of driving this, right? And so we get these black codes that start to emerge, but I want to talk about kind of the major congressional acts if we can.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think that it's important to get into. I mean, do you want to go into the Freedmen's Bureau?
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the congressional acts and then we'll talk about the Freedmen's Bureau.
Okay. Go ahead. Start.
So congressional reconstruction, starts. So during the Civil War, the Republican Congress is able to accomplish a lot of things they weren't able to do before the Civil War. Homestead Act, Morrell Tariff Act, the National Banking Act, the Morrell Land Grant Act, and maybe the most important, the Pacific Railway Act. The Pacific Railway Act, kind of constructing a railroad, a transcontinental railroad, had stalled for years because there was no consensus about should it cut across the middle of the country, should it go through the South, should it go through the North. And once the Civil War happens and Southern congressmen are no longer allowed to be seated, they can just make the decision. And they decide to construct this Pacific Railway Act roughly across the middle of the country. And they had done a lot of these things. And there's a fear with Johnson's actions that they were losing power. And they moved to something congressional reconstruction. So the 13th Amendment had been ratified early on in Reconstruction, but they moved to this creation of a Civil Rights Bill of 1866. And what they do a couple of things. First of all, they give all African Americans citizenship. They outlaw these emergent black codes in the South. And they send it to Johnson. Johnson vetoes it, and Congress quickly overrides it. They have the votes to override it. So this is basically from 1866 in April of 1866, when Johnson vetoes it, Johnson's presidency is neutered at this point.
Yeah. And then so begins the long drawn out sort of pissing contest, I would say, right? Mm-hmm. Between Congress and the executive branch. And it is just simply because of not having an agreement on a vision for what's going to happen. And it is interesting to see, though, how united Congress is. It's because there's, like you said, there aren't people who are seated right. to oppose. But like, it is kind of this cool moment where, but it's like, why are they so opposed when they technically should be on the same side? And, you know, I talk to students about this all the time in class. It's like, look, just because you're in the union doesn't mean that you are all in agreement with one another. Right. I mean, there's this idea that like, oh, well, the union is the savior and they're the best. And, you know, they helped everything and everyone. I had students when I taught at Penn State, students would say, you know, things like this, like, oh, we're on the good side. It's like, well, there's fracture even amongst people in the union. And you can see this play out at a really high level with the executive branch. Right.
Right.
Right. And there, because there's no consensus. And you do see, though, the congressional acts, like the Congress does start working together to move Reconstruction forward. And you do have some successful things that come out of it. And then, of course, the removal of Johnson eventually from office and Grant comes in. But you can just see it's kind of a mess. There's just no direction. It's directionless at this moment.
Well, so the 14th Amendment is Congress taking that Civil Rights Act of 1866 and making it a constitutional amendment, because they want to guarantee that should they lose control of Congress, it will be very difficult to remove those protections, that those protections will be in place. So it gives civil rights and citizenship to African Americans, you know, freed slaves.
Citizenship, that's so important.
But it doesn't explicitly say voting rights.
And that's the loophole where the South obviously exploits it. But to even have to have an amendment that says that Black people are citizens, I mean,
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so it also says that the electoral college representation is reduced if a state does not permit Black people to vote.
Well, because if you think about it, right, so if you're not allowing citizenship or voting or anything for a huge number of your population, if you're not allowing them to vote, but then they're counted in your right. population, then there's going to be a large amount of representation to your region or to your state based on population, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's reflective of who's voting, who's allowed to vote, and what their interests may be. And this is still an issue in the South, is that there's representation, but for people who aren't necessarily represented because of any number of issues, like not having access to polls, not having transportation, not having polls open around them. And all through the 19th century and then well into the 20th century, you have intimidation at the polls, burning ballot boxes, shooting people who come try to vote. But the punishment was supposed to be, if you don't let everybody vote, then you don't get the representation. So the 14th Amendment sort of pushes that, you know, forward, where allowing citizenship, but then not saying something specifically about voting. So it does cause issues.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's so, you know, there are other couple of provisions of the 14th Amendment, but Johnson campaigns against the 14th Amendment. The Republicans win a supermajority in the House. They win and the Senate in 1866. They win 2/3 in both, which means they can basically anything they decide to do will happen. The president cannot prevent those things from happening. And this is the beginning of military reconstruction, right? So this is where we get in the Senate, you get Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. And in the House, you get Thaddeus Stevens from Pennsylvania.
Also known as Radical Reconstruction.
Yeah, it's radical reconstruction, military reconstruction. Basically, what they're going to do is they're going to use the military to force the South to do these things that they want them to do. And so March of 1867, they divide the South into five military districts. I mean, people within radical reconstruction, the radical reconstructionists, wanted those old states obliterated. They did not want Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. They did not want them to exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. Not in the way that they had. And not with the same borders and everything yet. They wanted to completely redraw the map.
Right. And this is, again, this goes back to that idea they had formulated about state suicide, that by seceding from the Union, they had given up all rights to that. That they had taken a gamble, lost that gamble, and this was going to be the price. They summarily disenfranchised many, many Confederate officers and soldiers. Ex-Confederate states had to ratify the 14th Amendment before they'd even be allowed back in the Union. And every state constitution had to guarantee full suffrage for African Americans. So the vote had to be explicitly granted. And what did the military reconstruction not do, though? So it doesn't give land to former slaves, and it doesn't provide education. So it doesn't follow through on, I think we should talk about the Freedmen's Bureau now. It doesn't follow through on some early promises.
Right. And well, and some of, not just early promises, but some of the things that would have made a true transformation of life from enslaved to free, it would have made possible, right? So the Freedmen's Bureau is established by Congress in 1865, and it's an attempt to organize labor. So much of what we've been talking about in this episode is, when we're talking about reconstruction and we're talking about reforming things, it's more like reorganizing labor and the labor practices and the way it would look and function for the South. And so the Freedmen's Bureau is established in order to attempt to organize labor. O.O. Howard is put up in charge of it. The Freedmen's Bureau lasts from 1865 to 1870. They have just a Herculean task in front of them of what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be establishing schools, providing aid to poor and elderly people. They're supposed to be settling disputes between white and black people.
Medical care.
They're supposed to be giving medical care. They're supposed to be running now defunct hospitals that were set up as field hospitals. They're supposed to be running those to give care to people in the area. Basically, what they're tasked to do is like build a whole society again, ground up. And, you know, they had so many successes. By 1869, 4 years after their establishment, they had erected 3,000 schools serving over 150,000 formerly enslaved students. They did run hospitals. They did provide medical care. But it was just this impossible task that the Freedmen's Bureau was given without the proper amount of funding support and people there, right? There were only, I think, about 1,000 people who were deployed to the South to run the Bureau. And that's not a huge amount, right? If you're thinking about the vastness of the region. But what ends up being the major failure here is land reform, right? It's not having the land given out, like doled out to people evenly. And
I mean, that's kind of the lesson of inequality in the United States, though, right? Yeah. Is, and, you know, when we kind of later on in a later episode, as we kind of move through the second part of the U.S. sequence, one of the issues that comes up post-World War II is how home ownership, and then that home ownership cascades into things like getting mortgages to pay for college education for children. And, you know, this prevention of Black people from being able to get land really prolongs suffering in that community.
Most certainly it prolongs suffering, and then not allowing access to resources and constantly having to live month to month and never having wealth. That's the point, right? It's not like having some money, but it's wealth. It's inherited wealth. And that has been the continual challenge, is not having inherited wealth. And if you can't pass down wealth from generation to generation, each generation is forced to start from scratch in a sense. And after World War II, you really do start to see that with home ownership. But in the 19th century, in this case, I mean, there was this huge opportunity to make things better, to make things right, to give land. And, you know, I can't help but to say too, I mean, I live in the South now. I was not born and raised here. I did not go to school here, but I live here now. And you can just drive and drive and drive and drive, and there is nothing around. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this idea that the North was going to come in and they were going to build a labor system much like they had with the factories in northern regions and the railroads and all this kind of stuff. And that never happened. It never happened. And then you have all of this unoccupied land that nobody's allowed to own that could have been distributed. And I'm not talking about like a communist sort of distribution of land or something, but 40 acres and a mule, that could have righted so many wrongs that we're still facing right now to this day. And as I drive around and just see land, 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 I mean, this is the most poverty stricken. I'm in Mississippi, right? This is the most poverty stricken state in the nation. I think we're really close to West Virginia and Arkansas, right? But it's still much of a legacy of slavery, but a legacy of the failure of Reconstruction.
There's a stigma. Right. So you brought up the Freedmen's Bureau. I think that's an interesting thing too, because it creates a lasting stigma on the Black community.
In what way?
So you see, when the Freedmen's Bureau gets started, you start to see, and what I have to add here is I have to remind my students constantly, the North is no racial paradise.
No racial paradise. No.
And you get these Northern cartoonists who start to write these cartoons and do these kind of grotesque characterizations of Black men lined up at the Freedmen's Bureau's office. And kind of the legacy of that is this idea that it kind of continues that paternalistic model of slavery, right? That Black people needed white masters to actually function, that they were incapable of functioning on their own. And the Freedmen's Bureau in some ways continues that paternalist narrative, I would argue.
That's a good point. Yes. That there's this idea that there has to be government aid in order for people to even get by. But what's being missed there and is missed now is like, well, if you're being forced to live off of any sort of aid coming to you because you don't have access to freedom in the same ways that white people do, then of course it's going to look differently, right? So one of the really rich documents, or excuse me, one of the really rich archives that I always direct my students to, is the WPA narratives, right? Where they went around in the 1930s and interviewed former people who were formerly enslaved or who lived through Reconstruction in the late 19th century. And, you know, one of the themes that comes out of it in a few different interviews is that former slaves were not given a thing but freedom. And that if you're asking what is freedom, it's like, well, if I can't live and do the things that a white person can do, then I'm not free. And so to have these depictions of the Freedmen's Bureau that are coming from the North, that are like these heavily racialized, racist depictions of what's happening in the South, it's obvious that that's going to be have to be what's happening, because things aren't being corrected properly, if that makes sense.
Right. Right. No, it's, I'm just saying, I think the Freedmen's Bureau creates this stigma that continues, that persists even up to this day. Right. So I think when Ronald Reagan talks about the welfare queen with her Cadillac and all this, that these things, something we will hopefully discuss
when we get to the 80s. Yes.
I think when he does that, he's tapping into this deep-seated
legacy of, yeah.
Right, that people that, you know, that white people kind of wink at one another and say, well, this community wouldn't have done anything at all if it wasn't the federal government propping them up. Mm-hmm. And so we get the 15th Amendment gets ratified by 1870. And this is U.S. Grant. I mean, I'm going to skip over the stuff with impeachment. Johnson becomes the first president impeached. He's not removed from office.
Sounds familiar.
Just to remind you, Johnson's the first, Bill Clinton's the second, and Donald Trump's the third. None of them is actually removed from office, but all three are in fact impeached. Don't let anybody tell you differently. You know, Ulysses Grant, a general in the Union Army, becomes president, and the 15th Amendment is ratified, and it actually gives suffrage for black men. However, there are a lot of loopholes left in it, and states in the South, as well as in the North, start to exploit some of these loopholes. But, you know, I don't want our episode, we could easily go hours and hours about this. I want to kind of push forward to kind of some important groups that formed during Reconstruction.
Well, I want to say, though, with the 15th Amendment allowing the vote regardless of race, you have 2,000 African-Americans who hold public office during Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. 2,000 men, 2,000 black men hold office. And the very first black senator in the United States comes from Mississippi. And that's surprising, but not right. And so it's important to point that out too, that there were some successes during Reconstruction, and most particularly it's the establishment of schools. It's the establishment of the very first public school system in the South that's state funded. Then also the establishment of higher education in the South and in the form of now called historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, are established in the South, and they still function to this day. So there were a lot of successes, but in response to those successes, there were groups that formed. And I think that's where you were going. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So Hiram Revels is that first U.S. senator, the first black man to be a U.S. senator. I would say this. So the 15th Amendment is kind of a mixed bag because many women had been involved in abolition. And many women are a little perplexed because the 15th Amendment, it would have been very easy to include language about women getting the vote as well.
Correct? Yes, there was a huge splinter between Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony at this moment. And Susan B. Anthony said, you know, women have worked and lobbied and tirelessly fought for the abolition of slavery. And we've covered this in previous episodes. Women are always at the forefront of these groups for abolition. And they said, we would like to be included in the 15th Amendment, in the language of the 15th Amendment. And Frederick Douglass said, let the black man have his hour, I believe, something to that effect. And there was a major splinter between suffragists, women's groups trying to lobby for the vote, and then black men. And of course, you know, Black women weren't allowed to vote either, right? So women were left out of this, and it would have been easy. Another huge missed opportunity to right a wrong. Yes, women have to wait another 50 years to be extended the right to vote in this country.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting, even in its successes, there's failings, right? There are failings that happen in this project.
It's a mixed bag, like you said. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So during Reconstruction, 1866, an organization is founded in Pulaski, Tennessee, the Ku Klux Klan.
And this is essentially the military arm of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it is that's political. That's really how they... Yeah, that's how they function.
Yes, it I is mean, the military I mean, arm, yeah.
Well, they're terrorists, right? They're terrorist, they are domestic terrorists.
Yes.
And they rebelled against, you know, the military. They rebelled against what they viewed as radical rule in the South. You know, I think is it Eric Foner, I think, calls them the terror wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think he says that the military.
I think he uses some really strong language there. Yeah. And their goal is actually to sow chaos and confusion and eventually overthrow Reconstruction governments in the South.
Yeah, and it's called the Reign of Terror, right? Because mm-hmm. I think what's important to also establish about this era, about Reconstruction, that the Civil War ended. Violence did not. Violence in the South did not end by any stretch and actually increased in certain ways because it was more focused toward just ordinary citizens in a sense. Mm-hmm. And the because the Klan served as this military arm of the Democratic Party, they had open attacks on Republicans. I mean, it was very political and it was, like you said, a terrorist organization, but this Reign of Terror was targeting citizens, targeting politicians. By no stretch of the imagination did violence stop in, you know, Appomattox 1865, right? This is a very violent time. And the violence shifted, I would say, to be a little more focused and in a way more terrorizing because it wasn't militaries meeting on a battlefield. I mean, these were terrorists going and murdering people in the middle of the night, hooding themselves, you know, with hoods on, right? I mean, it was
the Invisible Empire.
Violent, yes.
So it's the Invisible Empire. And here's the thing. Much like Bacon's Rebellion kind of created a racial language that unites whites of multiple classes during the colonial period, I would argue the Ku Klux Klan, the Invisible Empire that develops in 1866, purposefully recruits from all social classes in the South, white social classes in the South. And it creates this idea that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether you're wealthy or poor. What matters is you are white. That is the thing that matters. And they annihilate Republican organizations across the South. Many Black men will not go vote because they understand that going out to vote is running the risk of being killed. And they're actually so successful in their first few years that the federal government actually creates a couple of responses, right? The enforcement acts, and they send federal troops in to kind of quell this intimidation. This is the very first time the federal government comes in to protect individuals like this.
Well, yeah, because it's interesting, right? Because you have this group that has emerged that is militaristic in their tactics, but then you have the United States sending troops in again. It's almost like a little mini war has gone off again, right? I mean, some sense. And I'd be interested to know, I'm sure people write about this and discuss this at length, but it's almost as if the war had continued at a certain point, that there was a resurgence in a way. But it was put down and the Klan went away for mostly right until like 19 teens and early 20s.
Mm-hmm. So we get after this, we get kind of after military Reconstruction is there. We get kind of the rise of the solid South, right? The South is solidly Democrat. They kind of start to construct a new philosophy called the Lost Cause. So the Lost Cause has a couple of main components. First of all, it's predicated on pro-Confederate patriotism. And you start to see states adopt new state flags that incorporate Confederate symbols. There's a contention that the South fought honorably and valiantly for independence, that it was all about Southern honor and valor, they kind of capitalized on kind of resentment and the humiliation that lingered from the war. And then finally, there is a ratcheting up and almost an institutionalization of violence. And there's definitely an institutionalization of discrimination towards Black people in the South, but there's almost an institutionalization of violence against Black people in the South. And I know this coincides with your work on prisons.
Well, and with no repercussion anymore, because at a certain point, I think it's important to sort of end our discussion with talking about the North sort of gives up on Reconstruction. And just sort of leaves the South to their own devices. The Democrats take over. They start running the government the way they want to run it. The North is exhausted by it. Because if you think about the amount of time that's passed, you have enough time that's passed where there's new people who are in government. And they're not as, you know, they're trying to forget about it. There's scandal erupting. People aren't paying taxes. There's tax evasions and all this kind of stuff going on where there's more for people to be worried about. And it's like, you know what, just let the South do what the South wants to do. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Well, ultimately, on the Republican Party sacrifices any last vestiges of Reconstruction for the election of Rutherford Hayes in 1877. I mean, you know, Hayes and Sam Tilden, it was an inconclusive election and it has to go, it's contested, and the Republicans strike a bargain that they will actually take the last federal troops out of the South from South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana if Rutherford Hayes is made president. So they're willing to trade a presidency for like the last chance they have at real Reconstruction. And basically from 1877 until the Civil Rights Movement, the situation for Black people in the South is dire.
And again, the violence doesn't stop. Lynchings are ratcheted up. People are stopped from going to the polls. Sharecropping and crop liens take effect, and people are, for all intents and purposes, re-enslaved, living in horrible conditions with no desire to, you know, improve circumstances of life, access to education. You don't see any more Black politicians in the South. It was just during the phase of Reconstruction. And yeah, it does have a lot to do with my research on prisons, because you start seeing convict leasing programs and we wouldn't call it mass incarceration in the 19th century, but Black people being arrested en masse and incarcerated to go work in fields, on chain gangs, and you do see the huge disparity of the races in that are imprisoned. And also, you have laws that are passed specifically to target Black people, right? The Black codes, mm-hmm. which we talked briefly about, but it's like vagrancy was one of the ones that, like, okay, well, if you're not working in a field, then you're vagrant, boom, you're in jail. You're in prison, and then you're going to be leased out. And so it's dire. You're absolutely right. And you know, now that we've covered a little bit of it, it is important to recognize the period of time between Reconstruction, 1877, and the Civil Rights Movement. It is not a short amount of time. I mean, people are suffering for about 100 years, more.
Yeah,
suffering.
It's almost 100. Yeah, it's almost 100 years, right? I mean, that's the thing is that so Black Americans spend the first 100 years of the nation's existence in slavery. They spend almost the first half. They spend the next substantial period of time in a situation that, while it's not slavery, is something bad in its own way. And we see this deterioration, right? So by 1881, we get Jim Crow laws start to get instituted. And by the 1890s, we get Jim Crow. And we're going to talk a lot about this. Lynchings go up and up and up. 1892, 230 Black Americans are lynched. Excuse me. I mean, it's a bad situation.
It is. And the other thing too, though, is like, even if there's migration, right? So we're going to spend the next several weeks dispelling the notion that things are rosy in the North. And Jeff kind of mentioned it previously, but you know, it's not like, okay, well, if you migrate to the North and things will be fine and you'll be accepted there. I mean, there is deep-seated racism happening there. Jeff's work, a lot of his work is about the West and about settlement of the West and about, you know, migration in ways into the West. And so we'll spend some time talking about that too. It was just like, it wasn't just Mississippi that was oppressing Black people, right? It's well, like there's nowhere to go and there's no plan for what freedom looks like.
Well, I mean, redlining is pioneered in the West. Redlining is pioneered in Los Angeles.
Yes, exactly. So we'll spend a good amount of time talking about that. But this does kind of lay the groundwork, I think, for discussion of the second half of the survey to understand the missed opportunities, the opportunities that were taken. And there were some things that came out of Reconstruction that were, you know, positive for the time being. But then so many of those missed opportunities to restructure society. And we will see the repercussion of that decade after decade after decade as we go through this sequence.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been great. It's good to get the podcast going again and hopefully get some information out that people can use in their new roles as master teacher to their children, or if you're just interested in history. If you haven't subscribed to our podcast, go ahead and do that. You can always visit us on unincompletehistory.com. You can find this podcast wherever you find podcasts. Join us next week. We'll continue this kind of sequence approach to U.S. history. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary. Thank you for joining us.
Until next time. Bye-bye.